Hello there, it's Antrice, and welcome to another episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast. Savvy Painter is the podcast for painters who know that mastering your craft is a lifelong venture. They understand that the hardest part is showing up every day, whether they're inspired or not, and that we're all in this together. For the past 3 years, the Savvy Painter Podcast has been sharing tips and techniques that you can use every day in your studio. And when you join the Savvy Painter email list now, you get a collection of inspiring quotes and practical advice collected from years of Savvy Painter interviews. Just go to savvypainter.com/subscribe to sign up for weekly emails and get your free PDF, Essential Tips for Artists. Each week, I interview established artists like Anne Gale, Scott Connery, Rebecca Crowell, and many other artists who are willing to open their studio doors, share their painting processes, and talk candidly about what it takes to consistently grow your skills. We get into the nitty-gritty of their daily studio practice, what tricks they play on themselves to avoid getting caught up in perfectionism, how to use flashcards as reminders to stay on track during long painting sessions, and other cool tactics to quiet the inner critic and continue moving towards excellence. The Savvy Painter Podcast is filled with artists who generously share their stories, and by sharing their stories, they show the rest of us that we are not alone. So join us with the Savvy Painter email list and get even more connected with weekly emails. Sign up now and you get Essential Tips for Artists, the inspiring quotes and practical advice collected from years of Savvy Painter interviews. Go to savvypainter.com/subscribe. It's that easy. Lorette Luzagic is a Toronto-based artist, photographer, and writer. She works in mixed media and collage and incorporates her writing and love of literature, poetry, themes from television, and movies into her work. You know, most people are afraid of public speaking, but imagine if you're giving a talk on your work and no one shows up. It happened to Lorette, but guess what? She is totally fine. She came out of it completely unscarred. And in this episode, Lorette tells you what she learned from that experience. We also discuss going through 1,000 bad paintings or miles and miles of canvas to get to the good stuff. She talks about her process, where she gets her inspiration, and since Lorette is also a lover of books, she recommends a couple of her favorites. So without further ado, here is Lorette Luzagic. Lorette, thank you so much for being on the Savvy Painter Podcast. I'm delighted to talk with you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very happy to be here.
Can you tell me how you've started out as an artist? I love hearing the sort of pivotal moments that people had that made them decide that they were going to pursue painting. And in your case, I know that includes writing as well.
So it was sort of a happy accident that I ended up focusing my life as a visual artist. I was always planning to be a writer before I could even write, that was the plan. And I actually went to school for journalism, and that didn't work out too well because it wasn't very creative. And I always made things. I made crafts and was drawing and doing a lot of stuff like that, but I wasn't very serious about it. And then after school, I was like, I can't write newspaper articles. This is not creative. It's horrible. And I took a vacation at my friend's place in Vancouver, and I decided I should learn the tarot and that maybe I should make tarot cards as a way of learning that. And I used collage to make all 78 of the cards. Mm-hmm. And it was just so fantastic a process. And everyone was asking, are these Photoshopped? And I didn't even know what Photoshop was then. And I just got hooked on collage like right away. And I never did go into news. So that's what happened.
What did you do after that? After you had that realization, how did you transition into making a living out of this?
So very quickly, I started incorporating. I thought if I can cut up images and glue them, I can start adding in other media and experimenting and it will be endless. And I got really hooked on like just very creative productivity. And I started to host art shows of my own and hook up with different artists, and we would just put up our own shows. And so I started selling right away. Of course, I was also working in a bookstore and other things like that, but I found that you just have to do it. You just do it. You don't sit around waiting.
It's so obvious, and yet so many artists have such resistance to that. But I'm curious if you ever felt any resistance to doing it, or was it always just, you know, I need to get my work out, I'm going to get it in front of as many people as I can and just start selling?
Well, I can't deny that I have that kind of imposter syndrome when you wonder, is this really happening? I mean, there in art history, I feel lucky to be a practicing female artist who sells work in all of history. That's not too many, and I'm happy to be a part of that. So I did feel fear that this isn't real, or I'm not good enough, or whatever, but you have to start somewhere. And I love the quote by the photographer Henri Cartier-Bresson, and he said, your first 10,000 photographs are the worst. And that was like, yeah, you've got to get it out from under you and do it, because if you wait or you feel fear, you'll still be making those first ones. So just do it and you'll get better and better.
Yeah, I wonder if it comes from him, but yeah, there's this similar thing for painters that your first 1,000 paintings are going to be awful, or, you know, something. It's basically the same thing, or that you have to paint through miles of canvas, or you have to get through that first 1,000 paintings before you can create any work that you're consistently proud of, I guess, is the thought process behind that.
I think that's true, because you would never open a car engine and start fixing it without practicing and learning, or doing brain surgery or a sport, everything. So when people assume that you are going, it's got to be good right away, they're not taking that experience and learning into account. And we have to go through it. It's initiation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think what I see often is we have this concept in the arts, especially, that you're born with it, that there's this innate talent that people have or they don't. And I think when people really believe that, anytime they do a painting that doesn't, or a painting, a drawing, any creative act that doesn't turn out the way they want it to, they see that as proof that they are not worthy, that they're not talented. And then you get into all the imposter syndromes that you mentioned, and all those demons start. It's like they kind of realize, like, hey, we've got an in, let's start yelling and screaming and really freak this person out.
I personally think that you are born with some kind of obsession, and the talent and skills will follow, and freeing your voice will follow. But when people feel they would like to make art and enjoy it as a weekend hobby, I encourage that, because there's no reason to get into this as a whole life unless you can't help yourself.
I agree. Do you remember the first painting you did that you were really proud of, that you thought, like, oh, I love this one, or just had this feeling of accomplishment after you did it?
Well, what I jotted down on the page where that was about this tarot deck, because I had no idea that I had this sense of composition and this skill with scissors. And even looking back at that now, it was 20-ish years ago, that I can't believe it. I mean, it's much more raw than I would like now. If I redid it now, it would be more refined. But I can see how there was this torrential creativity that was just under the surface, and the world of using all imagery as your palette just liberated me completely. I mean, I never had contemplated that collage is the ticket. It's not necessarily painting or drawing. Those things are just, those are for other people and they're tools for me, but the center is the collage act. The joy of juxtaposition.
Can you talk about how you incorporate your writing into the visual art that you create?
Sure. I've always been writing poetry, and I edit a poetry and art journal called the Ekphrastic Review. So it kind of goes both ways for me, having that pair of creativity, is that I write about art and I make art about writing. So literary themes will constantly surface in my work, from fiction and from poetry, whether in the titles or literally as collage bits inside. And I'm always using text and font really excites me. As much as I use themes from history and television and music, the sort of mainstay is these literary characters or themes and snippets will appear. And the viewer might not see them. They may not know that that's what that is. But if they have connected with that story, they'll know exactly what it is, and it will give them a deeper connection with the pieces.
I'm kind of curious if you've ever had a reaction to your work that stands out in your memory, and if you could tell the story of that.
Sure. I was doing the Toronto Outdoor Art Fair a couple of years ago, and one of the pieces I had made was not typical of my work. It was a kind of strange creature, maybe you could say Basquiat-like, although everyone is compared to Basquiat, so I hate that, although I love him. But it was an odd creature, and I don't usually make that kind of art, but sometimes it comes out. And it was hanging close to the bottom of the fence. And at the next cubicle to my booth was an artist who had a two-year-old baby with him. And the toddler was always coming over and standing right at ground level in front of this big smiling creature face and pointing and howling and giggling. And I've got a picture of that. And the dad would keep coming and taking him and going, oh, sorry. But he was like actually communicating with this otherworldly creature. He understood it totally. And it just impacted me so much to think you have no idea who your art can affect. I mean, this is a baby. And it was just the most wonderful. That's my favorite picture of all my shows, is the kid pointing at the thing and just with the mirth on his face.
I love it. I can just imagine it. And little kids, when they have zero self-consciousness at that point, right? So his reaction was probably 100% pure.
It was so beautiful.
Can you tell me, on the flip side, I would love to hear about a time in your journey when you encountered a setback or maybe experienced some sort of a failure. But most importantly, what did you take away from that experience?
So I have a long litany of neurotic fears and terrors, but one of the big ones for me was, and I have it every time, will anyone show up? It is, will I be going and nobody will go and it will just be a disaster? Well, that did happen one time. I had a presentation at the Niagara on the Lake Public Library, and that's the town I'm from, and no one came, not one. And I was just standing there and feeling very close to tears. And then I remembered an encounter I had, the concert. There was musician playing in Toronto, and there was only a small handful of people at the show, and I felt bad for her because she was just fantastic. And afterwards I asked her how she felt to come out and saw no one in Toronto was coming to see her, and she said, well, you came and I'm singing for you, and you sing for whoever comes, and you do it even if no one shows up. And so I thought, well, okay. And so my dad had dropped me off, and I'm like, sit down, dad, I'm gonna do my presentation. And that was just a sort of a practice to do it anyways. And when it was over, I thought, well, that happened now, no one showed up, it's done. And it really wasn't the end of the world. So you just have to live through these things. They're all trial by fire. I mean, they happen, and it never happened again. So
I love how you handled it, though, and just shifted your mindset so that you saw it as practice, even though I am sure it was, you know, when you say you're close to tears, I'm just imagining how you must have felt. And I can, there would be that moment of, oh my gosh, this is my worst fear. But then afterwards, there's that sensation of, oh my gosh, that was my worst fear. And guess what? Everything's fine.
Yeah, you live through it. And I try to be positive, because every experience and all of its variations are an opportunity to learn something, and also to practice doing what you do and handling something and seeing something differently. And so I try to see it that way.
I love it. I would love to kind of switch gears now and hear a little bit about your process. How do you come up with your ideas to start a painting? And I'll ask you again, in case we go off on the ideas part, but I'm also really curious just about your process and what you actually do in your studio.
Okay. So everything starts with what I call a seed. So that could be anything, but it will be one kind of spark, and it might be a line of dialogue or a book title I see, or it might be a font in an advertisement or even a color combination. And then everything kind of seeds around that original seed, like it just starts springing. So then I start gathering what might be interesting to juxtapose with that statement or that color combination, or it might be a weird image that I find. And it just, in a way, it's very random, but there are always sort of correlates that scoop the things in together. And the greatest part for me is gathering the collage images, like culling, I call it. And I'll just go through my drawers and go through all the things and pile up the snippets that I think will be interesting to go with it. And then I'll start working on the canvas, just putting something down and putting these things together to see where they might go. And I usually have loud music on so that that rhythm becomes incorporated as well into the piece. And it's very, very manic. I sometimes just go for 2 days. I don't even leave the house or wash my hair or anything. Like, it goes when I'm in that flow. Mm-hmm. It's pretty insane. And then there's a sort of denouement period. And I always like to revisit a piece. It's never finished right away, even if it is. I have to come back and start taking things out where they get too busy, or just realizing that in that high, it wasn't, you know, editing, you could mm-hmm. call it. And mm-hmm. that has to happen after the distance from the piece, because the first part is like having an affair. It's so creative and wild. But then after that, you kind of have to take care of administrative stuff and refine it. So to make it work.
I love that. I have a similar thought process, I guess, that separation between critiquing your own work or judging it or even asking in any way, shape or form the question of, is this good? That whole part is completely separate from the moments where I'm putting paint on the canvas. And it requires some discipline to do that, to kind of keep those thoughts at bay and just go with the instinct.
One of my biggest problems is everything becomes too busy because I put way too much stuff in. And that, I mean, in my early work, every bit of canvas has 20,000 things in it, and it's just way too much. So it's kind of the charm of it, but it's also the big drawback. And I really started to see major improvement in both the work and the sales when I started learning a bit of restraint, or putting space back in, or taking something down and out, just giving things room to breathe. So that was really a turning point for me, is learning to use some space or less is more, even though they're still really busy, because that's me. But there is room in the canvas now, and so you can actually feel the things instead of just feeling overwhelmed.
Yeah, it's very much like music. I always think that you can, the reason why a really intense drum solo, for example, is so kind of exciting and fun is because of the moments of silence that happen after it. Or, you know, like in any music, there's these, even if it's the briefest of seconds, there's a pause so that you can have something to contrast all that activity and sort of chaos with it. So I think visually we need that space. We need that pause so that your eye can relax for a second before it jumps back into the busy sections.
Yes, that's beautiful. Exactly the same in music or anything. You need a little bit of space to digest and observe what's there, and otherwise you can't really hear it.
Do you ever become attached to certain pieces in your work? Because you do collage, I'm curious about this. I was doing a lot of collage and I used to, it sounds terrible, but when I was in, I used to live in Argentina. And so I would go to all these old bookstores or antique stores and find really interesting materials. And a lot of them were old books. And so I would rip them apart and work with the books. And then sometimes I would get really, you know, I would know I need to change that, but I really like that segment of the book. And so I didn't want to cover it up or I didn't want to rip it out. Do you experience that where it's the actual piece of the collage that you're just like, oh, that was so cool. And now I know I have to cover it up or take it off.
It is really difficult because you pick out your favorite pieces or things that are interesting, and then you don't know what will happen later. So I had to really make peace with the fact that in layering, even you're spraying something, you can't necessarily aim exactly. And it has to be, you have to accept the randomness and you have to be able to throw it out if it's horrible. And you have to be able to paint over and carry on. Even just letting go, it really is part of it, because otherwise, what's the point of making layers? I should be doing something very meticulous. But I kind of made peace with that a long time ago. You just have to roll with it. It's all about chance and what comes together.
Can you talk a little bit about you gave like kind of a brief overview of how you create the piece. I know most artists who are listening to this there's actually probably a split. You got half of the people who are listening to this while they're commuting somewhere, but a lot of people are listening to this while they're in their studio actually working. And so these really nitty gritty, how do you do it pieces, I know are very, very much appreciated. So let's dig in a little bit into the actual process. Like, first of all, what do you use or do to ensure that things are archival, or do you worry about that? Is that an issue for you?
Okay, so yes and no. I try to use quality items when I can, such as the paint, and I use adhesives on top to make sure as best I can that everything will stay down for a long time and be airtight and so on. But I don't want any limitations. So if newspapers are not archival and I will tear them up and they get covered in various kinds of varnish or glue or whatever that will sort of plasticize them, but I don't worry about it. I mean, if Robert Rauschenberg and Basquiat and all of these were like, oh, I'm not sure this will last forever, I have to go with the moment. It's very instinctive and visceral and pop culture, and life is temporary. So I'm also not so pompous that I think, good grief, in 8,000 years, I'm going to still be in some museums. Like, I don't want that to limit me, and I just don't. So I try to take some kind of care, but I'm not going to give up using a broken old antique illustration just because it might not last forever. I can't.
I love it. I remember the school that I went to, they were very, very interested in archival issues. And so we had this whole class that was the properties of artistic materials. And it was all about both what's archival and what's not, and all the ways that you're going to die by being an artist. It was a lovely class, let me tell
Great
you.
That's going to be the death of me for sure.
And it made me really paranoid for the longest time. And so it really, what you're alluding to, it really impeded my work because I was so afraid of everything, you know, like, ooh, I don't know. What does that do? What's it going to happen? And what finally broke it was, you know, years later, I was studying with another artist and he's like, it's kind of similar to what you said. It's like, you know what, Antares, if people are still really interested in your art 1,000 years from now, all you're doing is...
You're fine.
Yes. They will spend whatever money necessary to fix any problems that might crop up. And, you know, if that's not enough, just...
It's a good problem to have.
Exactly. It's a good problem to have, and you're providing job security for archivists of the future. So, you know.
That's great.
I mean, not, you know, again, like you're saying, not to be irresponsible about it and use something that you know is going to fall apart in 2 weeks. But I think that a lot of those issues we overcomplicate.
I can't connect value only to longevity. The value is if somebody likes it now and responds to it. And if I have to limit my materials, then I'm not going to be, my vision is unique. Other people have other things, and what I'm doing is very different. So if somebody wants that, it can't come any other way. If I use only oil paint, I'm not this kind of artist. And that's great for those who are, because oil paint is the cream of the crop, but that's not how I work.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever get stuck? And if you do, how do you pull yourself out of that?
No, almost never. I have a very active, voracious curiosity, and it's the opposite problem. There's no getting stuck. It's trying to narrow and have enough hours to put it out. I am kind of like a volcano, and it's actually sometimes painful. So it's the opposite, how to narrow. Everything spins ideas. I can just look in a gallery or flip through an art book or some poetry, and then I suddenly have pages of lists of new thoughts and new correlations. And it's really, really, really manic, everything. So I don't know what I would do if I wasn't doing this. I mean, I would probably explode. But no, I never run out of ideas. If I never have another one, I have enough notebooks filled with thoughts for the rest of like the next 1,000 years of my life.
I love it. So, and I'd love that you're going to live 1,000 years.
Well, I have to.
There's work to be done. My God. Can you talk about your notebooks?
Yeah.
I guess that was a very broad question. I can leave it that way, or I can narrow it down for you if you like. I'm curious what your habits are with your notebooks.
So I just open it to a page and scrawl something down that will be illegible to anyone else in same collage, like random bits, sometimes paste in or just tear out something that I want to put in my clippings drawer later, from a flyer or magazine. So they're just sort of stuffed with my horrible handwriting and bits of dialogue I hear. I'm always listening to dialogue on the bus, or I'm taking photos of everything around me. So that is also fuel for what I'm just constantly collecting and consuming and trying to hoard it somehow, so I might be able to use it later. And that's the same, my notebooks, my clipping drawers, my digital photography, it's all the same. I'm just consuming and trying to hoard it in order to be able to reference it, which is impossible.
Right.
Yeah, it's just too much.
You're reminding me of this was so long ago, but when I was in Argentina, there was this blog, and all it was these random overheard pieces of conversation from buses.
Oh, that's beautiful.
It's hilarious because
I'm jotting that down now.
I'll try to find it for you and see if it still exists and they're still doing it. But it's, you know, some of it is just beautiful. Some of it is like, you know, little kids saying something to their parents. Some of it is young couples getting together or breaking up. So it's just all these little segments, little postcards of life from random people, which makes it kind of that much more interesting, or, you know, one side of a phone conversation, or just.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah.
I love that.
It's incredible. Living vicariously through you. Has anything stood out to you where you're just like, oh my gosh, that is gold. I have to do something with it.
Oh, off the top of my head. Maybe not.
I'm throwing you curveballs here.
Yeah, trying to narrow that to suddenly pull it out. My retrieval system is, I could think about it and email them to you. Off the top of my head, horrible. I can't retrieve anything like that. Sorry.
No worries. So there's so much to unpack with your work, because I'm just kind of fascinated by all the different places that it comes from. And so, again, this might be a random question that throws you off, but
I'll try it.
But I know people love this, because my listeners are are, I think, almost as nerdy as I am. I don't think anyone can quite catch that, but catch up to how nerdy I am. But I'm a voracious reader, and people are always asking me about books. So since I'm going to guess you are too, what books would you recommend to other people? Like, so let me say one fiction book and one art book.
Okay, so fiction, The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle by Haruki Murakami appears in a lot of my work in some small way. It's just so elegant but weird. It's surrealist and yet so real. And it's just an astonishing work of fiction. Everyone has to read this. It's just so brilliant.
Say the title again.
It's called The Wind-Up Bird Chronicle by Haruki Murakami.
I am familiar with that name. I know, yes. Like, that is a very renowned author.
It's amazing.
Yes. Okay.
It's amazing. I've enjoyed most of his works. The last couple I haven't read, but they are all a beautiful, elegant kind of surrealism. I'm repeating myself, but that's the best description. But that one is like just a landmark work. It totally twists your mind in a beautiful way.
How about an art book?
So I thought about this, and I think the most important thing every artist needs on their shelf is some kind of spectrum art history book, like survey, because it's appalling how little is now taught in school, where everything is like anti-aesthetic. It's about politics or theory or some junk. And people are graduating from art school. They don't know anything about art history. So even if you hate all of it and want to make anti-art, you have to have some idea of the beginning, the middle, of like religion and art, of different aesthetics, of the rule breakers, of just how it all fits together. And I would literally say, if nothing else, get some of Sister Wendy's books. They're simple and it will give you a platform. But all this really weird theory stuff, books on that come out of today's art school, and they don't even offer sometimes the like world art history. So I would say get anything in that line and use it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't understand that either, especially, you know, people who say they don't want to be influenced, or, you know, like they come up with all these different reasons, which when you think about it, it doesn't really make sense. And even if you want to be the anti-artist, you have to have something to, you know, it's like a swimmer. You need something to push off the wall from.
Yeah.
And if you don't know what that is, I don't understand how you're being anti anything. You're just sort of.
Imagine going to a cooking or medical school and not having a clue about food or the human body. I mean, really, it's absurd. But so that's what I would recommend. Absolutely.
Okay. Love it. I want to go back to your process, because I'm just fascinated by this. And I love hearing people talk about what they do when they're in their studio. Do you have any habits or rituals that start off your studio time?
Habits or rituals? Coffee and wine, depending on what hour of the day, are integral. To me, the most important thing is, as boring as it sounds, is routine and discipline. Like, my inspiration is abundant, but it's nothing compared to actually acting and doing. So every day I wake up, naturally, I'm a real early bird. I know a lot of artists work late at night. Not me. I get up like 5 or 6 and I just get started. And by noon, I will have so much work done. And it will be studio time, but also administrative, which I loathe, but is really important. And avoiding it means you'll avoid sales and shows. You have to be putting proposals together and answering questions and things all the time. So I try each day to do the most boring things first, or the hardest ones first, and then to have the luxury of just creative time for the rest of the workday.
I love what you just said, that avoiding the work means avoiding the shows and avoiding selling.
Until I can afford an assistant and a secretary, no one's going to do it for me. So I have to do it, even though I don't like it. You know, that's just how it is.
Yeah, I know. I keep wishing that the dishes would do themselves, and so far they don't.
That's right. Same thing.
It's true with all that other stuff, but it's so refreshing to hear you say that. And one thing that I'm hearing kind of flow throughout this entire conversation, I think, is this idea of using action to get past all the other stuff that happens. And what specifically I'm referring to is exactly what we just talked about. But also, we started this conversation by talking about your first shows and how you got yourself out there. And you were saying you just have to do it. And all the fears that we have as artists, that nobody will show up, that somebody will say no. The only way to get past those is to keep moving, is to act, is, you know, action is the only antidote, I think, to fear. At least that's what I've discovered, or been true for me, I should say.
Absolutely. I'm a really big believer in DIY, like do it yourself. And anything I don't like or want to overcome about the industry, well, then I find my own way, which doesn't always work out, but then I learn something too. But no one's going to do it for you. No one's going to discover you if they're not going to see inside your studio unless you're showing them. And you just have to get out there. And if you don't like something, a certain market or something, then find a different one. That's just how it is.
Amen. I love it. So, sorry, I'm trying to not just sit here and agree with you and tell you more reasons why I agree with you. But I'm pretty much going, yes.
Well, when I was just starting out, I had some real audacity. I thought, good grief, it will be like, you know, 10 years before I have a solo show at a real gallery. And that's just too long. And I mean, it's so embarrassing now. Those pieces were just awful. But I thought, well, you have your own solo show, like to debut yourself. And that's what I did. I hired a DJ and asked a friend to help me. And we had it in a friend's apartment. And I advertised that I was making 500 collages and assemblages and shrines and installations. And everybody should come to hear this fabulous DJ. And people came and people bought stuff. And I was like, this is how I'm going to do it forever. They'll be calling me. And that is starting to happen. So,
how long did that take?
How long did it take?
Before people started calling you.
Mm-hmm. Well, not long, but of course, it's not enough. Everything grows on a connection, but that doesn't happen right away. So, I mean, even now, sometimes someone is like, I saw this, your show 7 years ago, or at, you know, your work at my aunt's house, but I didn't call until now. So you just have to keep doing it and realize someone will see you at that fair and you'll hear about it later and so on. So it really builds. I would like to be a lot more successful, but I'm not afraid anymore that it's not going to happen, which is a huge thing, really.
That's enormous because it keeps you in the studio working and it keeps you focused on the things that are working and the actions that you can take today that, you know, will get you just that 1% or that one step forward, as opposed to everything that's in your head telling you why this isn't going to work.
Absolutely. I mean, this year I've sort of started my foray into international showing, which I hope will continue. So earlier in the year, I was invited to a symposium in Tunisia of international artists. And that was like a real turning point for me. And I'm very grateful to an artist named Ali Rashid who invited me. And that came about because a few years ago, I wrote something about his art and sent it to him. And then he said he was watching me ever since. And I got to work in person with him and with 30 artists from all over the world. And that was like my first major international event. And then just following that, now I'm getting ready for an art show in Mexico and I'm leaving on Saturday. So I know some people show all the time everywhere, and I've had a few small pieces around the world. But this year it's like starting, I hope, to branch out of Canada, which is great, but I'm ready to move further afield. So it's very exciting. It eventually happens. You just have to keep at it and keep getting out there.
I love it. What is your dream project? If there were no restrictions on time or money, what would you create?
Well, I would go on a world tour, taking pictures and cutting things out of newspapers and magazines in that country, and then make a huge series collating the whole world, not just the world from where I am. Like, that would be, I mean, I'm not sure that could even be undertaken, but that's, if $1 million came in right now, or even, you know, 200,000, that's what I would do.
If you could own a piece of art by any living artist, what would it be or whose?
Oh, so this was really difficult because there's thousands, but I think it would have to be a photograph by Joel Peter Witkin, because they're so weird and transgressive and they're horrifying to me, but I'm compelled by his obsessions. And he's a photographer who really pushes the boundaries of what's acceptable. And he arranges outsiders and dead animals and old antiques into assemblages or into tableaus that are really horrifying and beautiful. And I don't usually like art that is like, oh, here I bled on the canvas and it's so radical. I just don't get into that. So I really even have a hard time liking him, but he's surprisingly soft-spoken and sweet. And I just can't imagine being so obsessed that I would actually have just, it blows me away that someone could be so obsessed about their work. So that's what I would own.
Do you know, I don't know the answer to this question. Do you know, is that Jerome Witkin's brother?
I believe it is.
Okay.
There are two brothers, and one is really freaky and the other one is not so much.
Okay, so I haven't seen those photographs, but I've seen Jerome Whitcomb's paintings, and there are some that are sublime, but there's others that are absolutely horrifying. So interesting. I'll look him up, because I know Jerome Whitcomb's work, and I knew he had a brother as well, but I'd never looked up his work, so now I'm going to.
Well, I'm telling you not to look unless you're seriously, you can't unsee it. But if a macabre or, you know, boundary pushing appeals to you, then go for it.
Last question for you, Laurette. What advice would you give to yourself, the artist that you were, say, 10 years ago? So figure, you know, early 2000s. If you can think back to what you were doing then, what would you tell yourself?
Prioritize organization. It's more important than anything else. You have to get on top of admin and not procrastinate. You're wasting time if you don't. And yeah, everyone wants to play around in the studio. And that might be the joy of being a weekend artist, is that you can just do things for the joy of it. But if you want to earn money and not go to other things, you have to. And it's taken me so long to try to get organized, and I'm still struggling with it because that's not my nature. But again, unless you have so much income that you can pay someone to do it for you and tell you what to do, it's very, very important that you organize. I mean, I have such shoddy records of the early days. I don't know where my things went, and, you know, it's horrible. And it's a lot stronger in the last 8 or 10 years, and especially now. My records are becoming immaculate, but they sure were not. And I would miss deadlines for things. That can all be solved by being organized and attentive to focusing on those details. Very important.
Laurette, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. It's been a lot of fun and I've learned a lot.
I'm really thankful. I really was looking forward, and I'm so glad that we got the chance to chat.
I want to give a big thank you to Laurette for sharing so much of her story with us. Go to savvypainter.com and click on the podcast link to get show notes for this episode. You can also see Laurette's work and get links to those books that she recommended. For the past 3 years, just about every single week, I've been working hard to bring you tips and techniques to help you out in your studio. In-depth interviews with artists who are gracious enough to share their stories. And by sharing their stories, they show the rest of us that we're not alone. The Savvy Painter podcast has been downloaded over 1.3 million times since it started, and I am so honored that you choose to listen and be part of this community. And now I want to take a moment of gratitude to thank some of the very special people who support the podcast and help keep it going. So a big thank you to Don Jordan, Christine Curtin, Bruce Garrity, Shirley Williams, Jennifer Lessman, Elizabeth Quinn Baldock, Carolyn Green, David Gorski, The Roaring Artist, Deborah Wage, Pat Oxley, Virgil Dyson, Kathy Beeler, Maureen Nathan, Alexis Redden, Gail Height, Barry Koplowitz, and The Art of Joy. Thank you so much for your continued support. One more thing I want to let you know. This year, you can expect a lot more workshops from Savvy Painter. If you are an artist who struggles with getting painting time in or feels like you're always busy but never really moving forward with your art, then my workshops just might interest you. Past workshops include Mindset Mastery, a 5-week online workshop to help you get past the roadblocks that keep you from painting. In it, we tackle the inner critic, fears of artists, and setting yourself up for a successful creative day. The workshop, How to Develop a Relationship with the Right Gallery, helped several artists find the right gallery and show their work. So if this is something that interests you, you can go to savvypainter.com/workshop and get on the email list. This is separate from the main list that tells you when a new episode comes out. This is just for the workshop, so you don't get quite as many emails, but when you do, there's always something really good happening. Sign up now and get a downloadable PDF with case studies that tell you exactly how 3 artists pushed through barriers that were getting in the way of their studio time. You can, for example, learn how Rhonda went from not wanting to call herself an artist to getting her very first solo show. Also, listen to an introverted artist describe how she built her confidence and then spoke in front of an audience of her peers. And you can discover the tools that Samantha used to take back her power after a decade of believing that she had no, I'm putting air quotes there, she had no talent. So again, go to savvypainter.com/workshop to reserve your place on the list. When you sign up, you get that downloadable case studies that I mentioned, but more importantly, you get exclusive invites to upcoming workshops. Most of the time when I launch a new program, it sells out before I ever announce it publicly. So reserve your spot now at savvypainter.com/workshop. Until next week, this is Antrese Wood with the Savvy Painter podcast. Thank you so much for listening.